for WPFW News and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Good afternoon. This is the Shai Rana Show with your host, Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAIFM.
You're watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Ali Abu Na'meh here with my colleague, Nora Barrows-Friedman. And this week marks exactly 10 years since President Barack Obama authorized the U.S.-assisted Saudi and Emirati bombing campaign against Yemen, which killed thousands of people and caused one of the world's worst and ongoing humanitarian disasters. That bombing campaign was paused in 2022 as part of a UN-brokered truce that has largely continued to hold. Marking that anniversary, Shireen Al-Adaimi, a Yemeni-born professor of education at Michigan State University, wrote, "Maybe Trump forgot, but he failed in Yemen before, as did Obama and Biden, and he'll fail again." Of course, Al-Adaimi is referring to the fact that U.S. President Joe Biden also attacked Yemen, just as his successor Donald Trump is doing right now, despite that truce, and as retaliation against Yemen's ruling Ansarullah movement for its maritime blockade on Israeli shipping and its missile launches aimed at halting the Israeli genocide in Gaza. This is one of many key regional developments set in motion by the 7 October 2023 Al-Aqsa flood operation carried out by the Palestinian resistance and Israel's ongoing genocide. Joining us now to talk about developments across the region is Helena Cobben. She happens to be the founder of Just World Books, and she's also an author and analyst of great knowledge and experience. Her latest book is Understanding Hamas and Why That Matters, co-edited with Rami G. Khoury and published by OR Books. And we're really glad to welcome you back to the Electronic Intifada live stream, Helena.
Well, it's great to be with you. Can you guys hear me all right?
Yeah, you sound great. Hi, Helena.
Okay, hi. It's such an honor for me to be with you. And, you know, just what Nora was saying, that she feels that she or we failed the 200 journalists. I want to say, Nora, you haven't failed anybody, because you and Ali and the rest of the team here have been so faithful trying to bring the truth about Gaza to the broad English-speaking public. So just send you an electronic hug here.
Thanks, I appreciate that.
Thank you so much, Helena. And there are days when we really need those hugs. And
yeah.
We appreciate all the work you do. And we have a lot we want to try to talk to you about. And so let's get into it. 10 days ago, Israel abandoned the ceasefire agreement that had brought some respite to people in Gaza from the daily massacres of dozens of people that we are now seeing once again. The United States, which played a key role in brokering that ceasefire, is backing Israel to the hilt. Indeed, President Trump keeps bragging about how many weapons he's sent to Israel, just like Joe Biden did. Similarly, we've seen Israel constantly violating the ceasefire with Lebanon and refusing to withdraw from Lebanese territory. Given all this, what does signing any type of agreement with the United States and Israel even amount to? What are the lessons here?
Oh, thanks for asking that, Ali. I mean, I think it's really important if we want to look at the global kind of context in which all of this is taking place, is to see the absolute degradation of the United States' role in West Asia, both under Biden and under Trump now, as revealed by what's been happening in Gaza and since October 7th of October of 2023. So, you know, I was just looking at this record of two things called ceasefires in recent times. There was the one concluded last November between Lebanon and Israel, mediated by Biden, as it happened, and also with France kind of sitting in as what, co-mediator, co-conspirator, however you describe their role. And then the one that Trump's person, Steve Witkoff, managed to get the Israelis to sit down and sign with essentially Hamas through the mediation of Qatar and Egypt in the middle of January. So what is notable about both these ceasefires is that fire did not cease. And I think it's really important to underline that in both of these conflicts, the Israeli military continued, maybe at not quite the same level as previously, but if you're looking at Lebanon, you know, they were supposed to have come out of Lebanon completely by the end of 2024. They're still occupying five strategic hilltops. They're still overflying huge areas of Lebanon. They're still dropping bombs. And the United States is working hand in glove with the Israelis to try to impose very stringent political and economic conditions on the Lebanese people who, you know, have suffered billions of dollars of damage from the Israeli bombing. So, and okay, that's Lebanon, but obviously Gaza is very analogous. The Israelis never stopped their military operations in Gaza. They never ceased fire. Even after, you know, the many of the terms of the formal ceasefire went into operation, Hamas and its allies releasing Israeli captives, the Israeli military releasing hundreds of Palestinian captives, some degree of increase in humanitarian aid, but nothing like what was agreed, you know, in that agreement of January 15th. And by the way, that agreement of January 15th was supposed to inaugurate 3 6-week periods of progressively, you know, more Israeli withdrawal, more self-governance for the Palestinians, an end to the hostilities, hopefully. And we had the first of those 6 week periods and with, you know, very limited Israeli compliance. And then they shut down the humanitarian aid completely. And then on, was it March 18th, 19th of last week, they resumed full-scale bombing. So I just think it's worth underlining this shift, this notable degradation of the U.S. role. I mean, the U.S. has played a mediating role in previous phases of the Arab-Israeli conflict. Notably, it was only the United States that mediated the Israeli-Egyptian peace agreement and then the Jordanian-Israeli peace agreement. So those were already a bit of a departure from the UN, which the UN is supposed to be the global body for, you know, conflict resolution, mediation, ceasefire monitoring, all these things. That's supposed to be the UN's role. The US has usurped that role for quite a long time, but now we see it just completely throwing to the winds any pretense of being a trusted, neutral, independent mediator and arbiter. You know, it's like they don't care anymore.
Yeah, well, you know, under Biden, they pretended to care while shielding Israel from any consequences of perpetrating genocide and continuing to ship the weapons needed to carry out the genocide. The Trump team, as I've called them, are refreshingly honest in their open support for the genocide. They don't pretend like the Biden team does that they care about civilians in Gaza. But just very, if you have any sort of quick sense on what we can make of the incoherence, because as soon as Trump came in, or in fact, even before he was officially inaugurated, he insisted on the ceasefire in Gaza through his envoy, Steve Witkoff. That seems to have been the sort of final element that forced Israel to accept it. But they have been just as happy to abandon it. I mean, is there any logic here? Maybe we'll have time to talk about the logic of U.S. interventions or lack of it in the other topics we cover. But just on the ceasefire point quickly.
No, I mean, I don't think they make even a pretense to have a coherent policy. It's just like throw any policy out there and see what sticks. Remember, you know, Mar-a-Lago. I mean, Mar-a-Gaza, whatever. I mean, that horrendous, like, project that he threw out right after the Witkoff intervention. I think what's been happening in brief is that he wanted to score points against Biden by proving that he could nail down the ceasefire, which, remember, had been baked and ready since either May of last year or even since December of 2023, according to the Qatari foreign minister. So, you know, he wanted to make a point against Biden, like, you know, that he can do this. Also, maybe he was a little bit susceptible to the appeals of the Israeli hostage families. But now, after the very unsuccessful first 6 weeks phase, he's like, I don't give a toss, you know. The Israelis can do what they want. Actually, I rather like it if the Israelis do what they want. I think that's where his preference is right now. And it's notable that this envoy that he had for, you know, let's say about a week or two, Adam Bola, who was dealing directly with Hamas in Qatar, has now been reassigned to go and deal with other issues elsewhere. So, and has been very, I mean, Adam Bola said, oh yeah, you can do business with Hamas. We've got sort of the good outline of a way forward. And he was very, very optimistic about this. And now he's been reassigned.
Typical.
But coherence, yeah. Ali, I don't think you should.
Helena, I mean, you know, we've been talking about the non-ceasefire in Gaza, in Lebanon. Let's discuss a little bit about what's happening in Syria. In December, Turkish intervention helped topple the government of President Bashar al-Assad in Syria and bring Hayat Tahrir al-Shams, HTS, to power in Damascus. HTS, of course, is an Islamist militia whose leader Ahmed al-Shara, has been closely tied to al-Qaeda and ISIS. Since then, Israel has carried out unprecedented bombing raids on Syria, destroying its military assets and infrastructure, and has expanded the Syrian territory that it has occupied since 1967 beyond the Golan Heights, which, the invasions are just, they're pushing more and more north. What role are Israel and Turkey playing in Syria, and are they effectively cooperating? How do you see this kind of rolling out at this point?
Yeah, it's been interesting and for me, very disturbing to see what's been happening. I think I wrote or said earlier when all this started happening that it seemed to be a new sort of division of Syria's national territory, analogous to what the French and the British did back in 1917 with the Sykes-Picot Agreement. Now you have essentially Ankara and Tel Aviv dividing up Syria's national territory to the complete detriment of the Syrian people, you know, as we've seen most recently. To what extent they've been cooperating, I have to say a lot. And there's another actor that is interesting and slightly disturbing to look at here. Well, two or three, actually. But, you know, the Russians, as I had noted earlier, kind of stood back, although Bashar al-Assad was a key ally of theirs in West Asia, they stood back and essentially said either they let him fall or they had judged that he was so weak that it wasn't worth trying to keep him in power. So right now, the Russians are desperately trying to hang on to their naval base in Tartus, which is their only naval base in the Mediterranean. And so they're doing deals with Ahmed Shara, the HTS ruler of Syria, in order to try to have that happen. But we've had also, and of course you have the Americans in the northeast of the country and even down toward the Jordanian border. And so
I think if you look at Erdogan's point of view, he's been very happy to extend his power, you know.
Hold on Helena. A second, Helena, we're having an audio issue.
I think your microphone.
Yeah, we just strange. Need to fix that audio issue. We were getting a buzzing sound.
I'm sorry.
There we go. That sounds better. That sounds that's good. Better. Yeah.
Okay,
go ahead.
Thanks.
Go ahead.
We're good now.
Yeah. So Turkish President Erdogan has been trying to extend Turkey's power. He sees himself as a descendant of the Ottomans who ruled the whole area, you know, in the name of the Ottoman Sultanate. But he's also a Turkish nationalist. So he's been obviously concerned about the Kurds, both in eastern Turkey and in eastern Syria. So there's a lot going on there, but he seems to be quite happy to have the Israelis pushing forward on the ground in Syria, which they've done now in near Daraa in the south, yet again, I mean, just in the last couple of days, and the Israelis proceeding to destroy, you know, scientific and the last shreds of Syria's military capabilities. So you have to say that they are working together there. And remembering, we should remember, of course, that Turkey is a member of NATO. So, like, this is not wholly surprising.
Yeah, we'll come back to Turkey in a couple of minutes. But before that, talk about the Western embrace of Ahmed al-Shara, a.k.a. Abu Muhammad al-Julani, the former ISIS and al-Qaeda operative who heads the HTS militia, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. Western powers have recognized him as president of Syria, even though he has assumed absolute power with really no accountability, no checks, no talk of elections for at least 4 or 5 years. And recall that supposedly the uprising in Syria was meant to bring about democracy and freedom. And the Western powers have kept up their embrace of al-Shara and HTS, despite the horrific sectarian massacres of religious minorities in Syria, particularly the gruesome pogroms of members of the Alawite community in Syria's coastal cities earlier this month. How do you explain the Western alliance with such forces in Syria?
So I have a lot of friends and people whose analysis I really respect, who were supporters of the democratic opposition in Syria to President Bashar al-Assad. And they were hoping that they could get, you know, support of the West to bring this kind of flowering of democracy into Syria in the same way that they saw it happening after the Arab Spring, briefly in Egypt and less briefly in Tunisia. But, you know, that was all a long time ago. That was all like 13 years ago. I think fairly early on, it became clear to many of those pro-democracy Syrian activists that definitely the United States, that Washington had thrown its lot in much more with the Takfiri, the extremely jihadi extremists who were being supported, have been supported throughout by Turkey and also to some extent by Qatar. And I'm very, you know, troubled by the role that Qatar has been playing in all of this. So,
and the United States, sorry to interrupt, but we can recall that famous email leaked by WikiLeaks from Jake Sullivan in 2012 to Hillary Clinton, who was then U.S. Secretary of State. And he said it plainly in this language, AQ, Al-Qaeda, is on our side in Syria. And then, of course, later Jake Sullivan became, until just a few months ago, the national security advisor for President Joe Biden.
Yeah, I mean, they're kind of continuing support, sometimes covert, sometimes more overt, but definitely including supporting Turkey as it transferred arms to Al-Qaeda, and supporting, they had a joint operations room in, I think, in Çıraklık Air Base in eastern Turkey, and another joint operations base in the north of Jordan that was coordinating all this military and political aid to essentially the jihadi opposition in Syria. But, you know, they couldn't, apart from, you know, Jake Sullivan's email, they couldn't really fess up to this in public. So, you know, they kept very tight sanctions. Well, they kept this, Abu Mohammed Jolani had a $10 million bounty on his head from the United States until very recently. I mean, until after he had seized Damascus. And then I think the Biden administration lifted the bounty on his head. But they're still wary of lifting the very tight sanctions on Syria. I think they don't know what to do. Partly because this guy, you know, his people, HTS, they've been doing some very bad things in Syria. And the Israelis want to keep him as weak as possible. He has done nothing, not taken one single step to protest or to resist Israel's actions in Syria. I think that's really important to underline. And the other thing that's important to underline is his complete, just willful not looking at what's happening in Palestine. I mean, for any political actor in Syria throughout, you know, the last 100 years, Palestine has been at the heart of their concerns. You know, sometimes it worked well for the Palestinians, sometimes it didn't. I mean, I've been in Lebanon when the Syrians were trying to get rid of the Palestinians in Lebanon, and it wasn't a pretty sight. But you cannot be an effective political leader in Syria unless you have a very strong Palestinian policy. And he really just doesn't want to talk about it. He doesn't want to talk about Israel and all the bad things Israel is doing. So there's a kind of, I want to say it's like a vacuum in terms of what's happening in Syria on the Palestinian issue. I did read somewhere recently that Khaled Mishaal from the Hamas leadership, who, you know, had been based in Syria for many years until about 2011, 2012, when he had to leave under circumstances we can discuss later, but the whole Hamas leadership had to leave, political leadership, but they continued to have military coordination with some of the forces in Assad's Syria. Now, Khaled Mishaal wants to go back and see if they can have that same military coordination with the new regime in Syria. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Ahmed al-Sharaa seems to be just playing the U.S.-Israeli game there.
And it's also notable, of course, that Khaled Mishaal, who was the former top leader of Hamas before he stepped down, and Ismail Haniyeh, who was murdered by Israel last year, replaced him. But Mishaal was particularly outspoken in support of the regime change in Syria. And it's notable that the new regime has not and will not receive him. And they've received all sorts of well wishes from all over the region. And of course, from Europe, the German foreign minister has been several times, and a parade of American and European officials have come to Damascus to meet the newly installed self-appointed president. So, so that's bad luck, I suppose, for Khaled Mishal. But I don't know if you want to say more about that, but we could also, we have a whole lot of issues we want to get through with you, Helena, so I'm eager to get your views on a number of things. So,
On Syria, I think it's important to note these sectarian pogroms that have been taking place on the coast, in particular against members of the Alawite minority and members of the Christian minority. And many thousands of these people have actually had to take refuge in the Russian naval base, which is interesting. That's one good thing the Russians are doing there. They're providing a refuge. But of course, it's also spilling across the Lebanese border very, very heavily. So the military forces that Ahmed al-Sharr has at his disposal include all the people from Hayat Tahrir al-Sham who were with him ruling Idlib in a fairly oppressive way for the last few years. And they include Takfiri jihadis, extremist jihadis from all around the world, including the Uyghurs of the East Turkmenistan Islamic movement, who are apparently some of the most brutal. And all of these people have been, you know, filming themselves committing horrible atrocities against minorities. Syrian.
And that so-called East Turkestan movement has been fully and closely backed by the United States for many years. So again, that's another tie-in. Maybe a topic for a special discussion at a later date. But let's move on to, or rather, let's come back to Turkey. Nora, do you want to introduce that?
Sure. Yeah. On Sunday, Turkish authorities jailed Ekrem İmamoğlu, the mayor of Istanbul, who's widely seen as President Erdogan's main political rival and the likely presidential candidate of the opposition Republican People's Party. His arrest, ostensibly on corruption charges, is viewed by many as the pretext for a political crackdown. Talk about the significance of what's happening in Turkey kind of internally, politically, and how it relates to the developments in Syria in particular. And the timing of this is very interesting. What do you think?
Yeah. Erdogan is an interesting actor, honestly, in West Asia in general. When he came to power, he seemed to be representing a kind of democratic Islamist trend that many of us thought was perhaps a useful and positive trend, given Turkey's history of very authoritarian military rule, that was what they call Kemalist, which means in the tradition of Kemal Atatürk, but also extremely anti-democratic and acting in the name of a kind of a secularized form of Turkish nationalism. So that was before you had Erdogan, and then he came in, 20 years ago? I mean, he's been in power for a long time, having been the mayor of Istanbul. So he knows the power of that position. And so I think he was very worried because this İmamoğlu, the new, the potential challenger, is from Istanbul. He knows Istanbul politics, and he's sort of a direct descendant of the old Kemalist trend in Turkish society. So it's a real struggle inside Turkish society for how they want to be, like to what degree they want to be. Well, you know, the trouble is Erdogan abandoned his support for democracy quite a long time ago, and has been acting, you know, increasingly like a dictator, especially in 2013, 2014, 2015. He had some very bad crackdowns. So all this time, of course, he has been a full member of NATO and hosting the important American military base there in Çıralık, and more or less supporting what the United States has been doing in the rest of West Asia. So it's hard, honestly. I don't know enough about Turkish politics to be able to say whether this is linked to Erdogan's Syria policy or not. I have noted in some of the writings and analyses coming out of right-wing Israeli think tanks that they think it's time that Erdogan had his wings clipped because of his expansionism into Syria, into essentially Syrian space that Israel wants to dominate. So it may be linked. I don't know.
Well, it's certainly interesting that whether he intended to or not, Erdogan did Israel and the United States a big favor by helping them achieve their goal of toppling the government of Bashar al-Assad, which at the very least was an asset. It wasn't a very active part of the axis of resistance, but it was, you could say, the hinterland to an extent of the resistance in Lebanon, in that it was, the term that's often used is the land bridge between Iran and Hezbollah. And that was one of the key reasons that the government of the Assad government was a target for the West for so many years and for Israel. But it's, you hear a lot of people in the region, you know, there's a lot of attachment to Erdogan because of his Islamism. And I've heard some people argue, you know, that and also because of his rhetoric about Palestine. He has a very strong rhetoric about Palestine, not such strong action, but certainly rhetoric. And some, you hear debates where some people say, well, if someone like İmamoğlu comes to power and the Republican People's Party, which is traditionally very pro-NATO, very pro-American, very pro-Israel, that is sort of a loss for the Palestinian movement. I mean, this is, of course, aside from the internal politics of Turkey, which I'm sure is on the mind of Turkish people more than anything else. But on the other hand, I've heard people say, well, Erdogan really hasn't done much for Palestine. He is still part of NATO, or Turkey under Erdogan is still part of NATO. Turkey is essentially doing the bidding of the United States and Israel, but Erdogan is covering it up with this Islamist and pro-Palestinian rhetoric. So it's better, again, to sort of pull the mask off and let Turkey go back to its sort of, or the modern Turkish Republic go back to its Kemalist, openly pro-Israel and openly pro-NATO roots, and not allow Erdogan to sort of bamboozle people by giving good rhetoric about Palestine, speaking about sort of a pan-Islamic solidarity or whatever you might call it, while still serving NATO and Israel. What do you think about that?
Gosh, Ali, I have to say I don't envy you or other Palestinians having to deal with this horrendous, like, West Asian political. I mean, it's not just a mix. It's an absolute festering stew of you know, different ideologies, different allegiances, and nearly all these external actors. Let me say, just about all these external actors put Palestine very low on their list of concerns and use it, as you kind of indicated, instrumentally. But that provides a really nice bridge for us to start talking about the one political actor in the region who is an Arab political actor who does not use the Palestinian issue instrumentally. Ta-da! Yemen.
Yes. Well, let me ask you about Yemen. Of course, as we noted, President Trump is bombing Yemen and has claimed that the Ansar Allah movement, which governs most of the country, or certainly the most populated parts of the country, including the capital Sana'a, that his bombing campaign will result in Ansar Allah being completely annihilated. I'm going to ask you how likely that is, and also ask you about your reaction to the now very famous Signal chat that has been leaked and covered by a lot of media, in which top US officials were discussing their attack on Yemen. The Democratic Party and Democratic leaders, if you listen to some of the Senate hearings yesterday, I think it was yesterday, in the last couple of days, where they were questioning Tulsi Gabbard, the Director of National Intelligence, and others, those Democrats were really focused on the admittedly laughably poor and amateurish operational security at the highest levels of the Trump administration. What they didn't talk about so much, and what I want to ask you about, is what did we learn about the substance of American thinking from that Signal chat?
American thinking, yeah, in the Trump administration, in the Trump era, I don't know, I used to worry about how one would characterize Biden's brain. And now I have the exact same question about Trump's brain, or the brain of his whole national security apparatus. So I think what we learned was a number of things from the Signal chat episode. One is that all of these members of the National Security Council, the so-called Principals Committee, are like a group of seven-year-old boys when it comes to the idea of, you know, anything to do with bombing and military stuff. And honestly, it turns my stomach, as somebody who has covered wars on the ground, the cavalier way in which they talk about this stuff. You know, without any recognition that there are human societies at the targeting end of these missiles and bombs. And, you know, it's like Karl Clausewitz 101. You know, what's important is not your military, whatever you can do, like you can kill, you know, thousands of people. What matters is the political goal, and are you going to realize it? So I think Shireen Ladamy was quite correct to note in her brilliant tweet there that this series of assaults against Yemen that was launched by Mohammed bin Salman when he was still only the defense minister of Saudi Arabia, and he thought he would manage to topple Ansar Allah, the Houthis, within 15 days. And here we are 10 years later, and Ansar Allah is actually operationally far more capable than it has ever been. Of course, along the way, we've had hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, women, men, children killed by the Saudis, by the Emiratis, and more recently by the Americans and British and French directly as a result of these military outrages that they are committing against the people of Yemen. So I guess what I learned from reading some of these Signal messages was just the childish, ridiculous completely apolitical nature of these people who are making decisions on behalf of all of humankind and have their fingers on the nuclear button. I mean, it's really terrifying, honestly. But so I learned a couple of other things as well. First of all, they said victory, like, you know, you deliver a couple of very high tech weapons to their target. Is that victory? No, of course it's not victory. All it is you've dropped the goddamn bombs. And then they say that they want this to restore freedom of navigation. And then, of course, there was the whole question that J.D. Vance raised, like, in whose interest is this freedom of navigation? Isn't it actually more in the interests of the Europeans? So we did learn quite a lot of interest about the depth of anti-Europeanism, or let's say Euroscepticism, at high levels of the Trump administration.
And I mean, you're talking about J.D. Vance, of course, the vice president of the United States, and what he said in that text chat. He was expressing skepticism about the attacks, saying this isn't a U.S. interest. Most of the ships that pass that way are European, and so why should we do that? But he didn't mention Israel. And I mean, how, even at that level, in a signal chat they thought was private, they couldn't.
Well, somebody, I think Pete Hegseth, mentioned Israel. He said, we want to do this. And they did it on March 15th, remember, which is quite a long time ago. We want to do this because either the ceasefire will break down, the Gaza ceasefire, which, you know, as I said, the ceasefire was never really there, but it did, you know, very aggressively break down 3 days later. He said, we want to do this because either the ceasefire will break down or the Israelis will get to Yemen first. Like, we want to race them. We want to get there before the Israelis do it, which was distasteful and bizarre beyond belief, honestly. And so they got there on March 15th, and then they've been doing periodic bombing ever since. The Israelis, over the last 2 or 3 days, have joined the bombing parties. And as we know, Ansar Allah responded with some missiles that were sent toward Israel. I'm not sure. I think maybe one or two of them got through, and one or two of them were downed by the Israeli Iron Dome, or whatever it's called. But there, I mean, I think they took it for granted in that principles committee signal group that, of course, this was all about Israel. But it was also about this so-called restoring freedom of navigation. But the reason that freedom of navigation has been interrupted by Ansar Allah, and it's worth underlining this at every possible opportunity, is because they are the only body that is seriously implementing and undertaking their responsibilities under the Genocide Convention to end the genocide in Gaza. I guess Craig McIver talked about this quite a lot last week, you know, that this is a responsibility under international law to end a genocide, to prevent and end a genocide. So Ansar Allah has been doing this primarily by interdicting shipping that's going to Israeli ports, and they've done that actually very successfully, forcing a lot of shipping to have to go all around the southern tip of Africa in order to get from the Indian Ocean to the Mediterranean Sea. But even this amount of targeted blockade action by Ansar Allah has not, obviously, as we know, been sufficient to end the genocide. So that, you know, leaves it up to those of us who are here in the United States to do what we can to force our government to end complicity with the genocide. And that's such a huge task. But, you know, if the impoverished, deeply impoverished Yemenis can do it. I think tomorrow, maybe let's put up a couple of the little graphics that I have, because I know people are not terribly. Yeah, okay, this is a great one. This is from a book that actually, as it happens, my company published, and it just shows you the gross domestic product per capita of the various different countries in the Arabian Peninsula. You see Yemen over there on the right, and you see the one that has the most per capita over on the left is Qatar. So, you know, Yemen is such a low income country. And then, Tamara, if you could show the map with the population density. Yeah, can make that a little bigger. Anyway, whatever. So that's fine. So what I'm looking at is population densities of the different countries in the Arabian Peninsula. And the big takeaway from that is that Yemen, which is there in the sort of bottom left-hand corner, has by far the greatest population density, specifically there around Sana'a, of any of the other places in the Gulf. And then the other one that I had prepared tomorrow, which shows, I mean,
yeah.
So these are the locations of US military bases and access agreements in the Arabian Peninsula. And really how very, very inconsiderate of Yemen to have located itself so close to so many of these wonderful American bases that are protecting democracy and the freedom of navigation. I just think, you know, the Yemenis really shouldn't have done it. Sorry, that's my like attempt yeah, at humor here
dark on humor,
a very
yeah.
non-humorous day.
People are, yeah, people often don't recognize that Yemen is the most populous country on the Arabian Peninsula, with at least 40 million, I've seen some estimates that say 45 million residents, which is more than Saudi Arabia. And as you note, its per capita income is it's by far the poorest country in the Arab world, and certainly the poorest on that peninsula. And its location by the opening to the Red Sea gives it an incredibly important strategic location, which is why, of course, the Barack Obama-backed coalition carried out this campaign to try to install a Saudi-backed puppet regime in Yemen, and have so far failed to do that. So it would seem that the leaders in Yemen understand that. I mean, when you listen to their speeches, it's clear that there's a conviction in terms of acting in solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza and saying that no amount of U.S. bombing will break that determination to do so. But they may well also understand, in fact, I'm sure they do, that the ability of Yemen to be a sovereign and independent country and a country that can develop for its people is directly tied to the freedom from U.S. imperialism in the region, and that they seem to understand that Israel is sort of the keystone of U.S. imperialism. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
Yeah, I don't know too much about the Houthis, but I think they're very steadfast. And one thing that I've noticed from my time in Lebanon and writing about Lebanon is that these countries that have what you might call mountain fastnesses, you know, whether you're talking about Mount Lebanon, which was always a place for embattled minorities to go and have refuge, talking about, you know, the Maronites, the Druze, the Shiites, they really managed to hang on to their societies in the mountains of Lebanon. And I think the Houthis, Ansar Allah, who come from mainly Yemen's Zaydi sect, which is a kind of a Shiite sect, but it's not only the Zaydis who are with Ansar Allah, that those mountains are virtually impregnable. And, you know, the Saudis, goodness knows, the Saudis, you know, are so close to Yemen. And they had all the latest military technology, and they could not break Ansarallah over the course of, you know, 7 years of war until they finally kind of took a step back. I have a question that I want to research a little bit more, and that is the degree to which the Saudis are providing targeting help for the US-UK current attacks against Yemen. And I think the answer may be no, because they know that those US-UK attacks are very closely coordinated with Israel. And I think right now, MBS doesn't want to be associated with that, but I need to get more information.
And as I understand, it was the US that was providing targeting information and other logistics support to Saudi Arabia and the Emirates when they were bombing Yemen. So if anything, it might be the other way around, but certainly a question worth asking. We just have a few minutes left, Helena. So let's spend the time remaining to sort of pan out a little bit. You've often noted that, I'm going to wrap these last two questions together because they sort of cover the same similar ground. You've been keeping your eye on developments in and around Iran, including Iran's recent naval exercises with Russia and China. So I want you to talk more about what you're seeing and how you think Iran's leaders are reacting to escalating threats from the United States. You'll recall that Donald Trump, when he attacked Yemen, claimed that the Ansarullah is just a direct proxy of Iran and is acting on Iran's instructions, which is obviously an oversimplification of the relationship. And as I said, Iran has held naval exercises with Iran and Russia.
China.
Talk about Iran, but then also talk about Russia and China in the context of the shifting global balance. On the one hand, it's widely observed that there is a relative decline of US power and a rise of Russia and China and other powers, a sort of a multipolar world, if you will. But right now, it does look as if US power remains unchallenged. And the main signal pointing to that is that Israel, with Washington's backing, continues to perpetrate this genocide in Gaza in the open with virtually no international action or response other than Yemen. And that Yemen is now alone. So give us some broad strokes in terms of what you're seeing around this set of issues.
So it's absolutely true that the United States global power has been diminishing, and it has not diminished anywhere near as fast as I would have hoped. I mean, I lived through the collapse of the British Empire when I was a child, and the collapse of an empire is not a pretty thing to watch, because empires only ever maintain themselves through violence and through spreading divide and rule and through grossly interfering with indigenous societies. And the same is true of the American empire. So, I mean, I want to make two points here. One is that maintaining and sustaining an empire is anyway a violent undertaking. And secondly, that the end of empire is often very violent and messy. On the other hand, once it's ended, then that's better. So that's kind of the broad way that I look at these issues based on my childhood and youth growing up in England. So US power has been unilaterally exercised essentially since the end of the Cold War in 1990. So that's been like 35 years now. And this unilateral hegemony is definitely on its last legs. Thank God. You know, if you think of all the terrible things that have happened in Latin America, in Asia, in West Asia, as a direct result of American imperial greed, then bringing this to an end is obviously a good thing. And for societies to be able to breathe again and to liberate themselves and to develop under conditions of national sovereignty within a multipolar world. So China, and to a lesser extent Russia, and the other members of the BRICS have been playing an important part in this. I have a few reservations about them.
For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Tuesday, April 9th. Here are some headlines. In a dramatic move today, President Trump says he has authorized a 90-day pause in the higher tariffs for most countries he announced last week, while maintaining a 10% baseline tariff across the board. The tariff pause does not apply to China. Earlier today, Beijing said it was hiking retaliatory duties on U.S. imports to 84% from 34%. Canada enacted a 25% levy on auto imports from the U.S. that do not comply with the 2020 U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. And the European Union member states have voted to approve retaliatory tariffs on $23 billion on goods in response to Trump's 25% tariffs on imported steel and aluminum. The EU tariffs will go into effect in stages, with some on April 15th and others on May 15th and December 1st. Meanwhile, Trump has been saying that tariffs on foreign-made medications are coming soon, with the goal of bringing overseas manufacturing back to the United States. Experts say that such tariffs could result in higher prices and shortages of generic drugs. Pharmaceutical products were mostly exempt from the round of tariffs that were scheduled to go into effect today. In other news, a federal judge yesterday issued a preliminary injunction ordering the White House to restore full access to the Associated Press to report on presidential events. AP sued the Trump administration in February after the White House limited AP access to President Trump's events, the Oval Office, and Air Force One, because the wire service continued to use the phrase Gulf of Mexico after Trump renamed the body of water the Gulf of America in his ruling. United States District Judge Trevor McFadden, who was appointed by President Trump, said the First Amendment prohibits the government from punishing the news organization for the content of its speech, even as AP lawsuit moves ahead with its charges. The judge gave the government a week to respond or appeal the order before it comes into force. In more legal news, the American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit yesterday on behalf of two Venezuelan migrants who expect to be deported under the Alien Enemies Act and face possible removal to a Salvadoran prison. The suit is the first in the wake of a Supreme Court decision lifting a temporary restraining order from a lower court order that had blocked the Trump administration from using the law to deport people. In a 5-4 decision on Monday, the justices handed President Trump a partial victory when it decided that the Trump administration can resume deportations of alleged Venezuelan gang members under the Alien Enemies Act of 1798. But the court said detainees must be given due process to challenge their removal. At least 137 people have been deported by the Trump administration under the Alien Enemies Act, a move widely condemned by legal rights groups.
Many of the deportees do not have U.S. criminal records, an ICE official acknowledged in court documents. For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin.